Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you once again from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today, after a somewhat longer break than I had anticipated, I am pleased to be once again behind the microphone here and delighted to be able to welcome on this the 10th of September 2015, and therefore the eve of the 14th anniversary of that fateful day on 9/11. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the programme Richard Gage, AIA, who is no doubt very well known to the majority of listeners to The Mind Renewed, but just for the sake of those who may not have encountered him yet, Richard Gage is a San Francisco Bay Area architect of some 28 years experience and a member of the American Institute of Architects. He is also the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which now numbers more than 2,350 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center high-rise buildings on 9/11. Richard Gage, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Thank you, Julian. It really is my honor to be with you here today.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, because it is a great privilege for me to speak to you, because I've admired your work for many years in challenging the official account of 9/11 and encouraging people to think, at least to think, about what happened that day, no doubt at some personal cost to yourself. So thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. Now, what I'd like to do with this interview, given that we've had a series of programmes over the last couple of years looking at 9/11 in quite some detail, really, I'd like today to get perhaps something of a broader picture of what happened to the buildings on that day from your perspective. That's not to exclude some detail, of course, but generally a broader picture for people to take in, and also to ask you about your own journey into this particular field of activism, about the work of your organisation, Architects and Engineers 9/11 Truth. So let me start, if I may, with your story. Now, you are an architect of almost 30 years' experience and a member of the American Institute of Architects. So what kind of projects have you been involved with over the years, and what does that involve?
Yes, I've certainly worked on a lot of different kinds of projects, including residences, but all the way up to the most recent project, which was a $400 million mixed-use project in Las Vegas with 6 blocks of retail parking structure and mid-rise office space, altogether about 1,200 tons of fireproofed steel framing in that project, which I had the construction administration and construction documents responsibility for.
So would you say that your experience of working on these kinds of buildings actually puts you into a good position, technically, to judge what happened to the World Trade Center buildings?
No architect's experience puts them in a good position to understand immediately or intuitively what happened to those buildings. It takes a lot of research, a lot of looking at a lot of evidence, which wasn't available in the mainstream media, wasn't even available in the official NIST reports, National Institute of Standards and Technology. We're talking about controlled demolition today, Julian, and no architect is trained in that field. But anybody who's an architect or not can learn about it and can discover what it is that we were really looking at with some degree of intuitive ability as well.
Sure. So what was your initial reaction to the dreadful events of 9/11? I mean, did you look at the images at the time, you know, on the news reports and actually think, you know, with this architectural point of view that you have, there's something not quite right here? Or
well, that's the thing. On 9/11, I'm looking at the TV. I'm watching these buildings being destroyed from the top down very explosively. I'd never seen that before. We'd never seen, in fact, a high-rise collapse before, other than with controlled demolition. And which is an implosion-type technology like the old hotels in Las Vegas, which the third tower that we'll be talking about today did, in fact, look like, but which the twin towers were very, very different. They were explosively destroyed from the top down in a mushroom shape, series of symmetrically ejected geometry of fireworks, laterally ejected structural steel sections freely flying in every direction, 600 feet, 200 meters all around them. Yeah. And we were in a state of shock. We were under attack after we realized the second plane was there. And the story just sort of unraveled our minds as it was unraveling in its level of detail as well. So we were not in much of a position to accurately describe to ourselves or anybody else what was really going on, especially after we were told that it was a gravitational collapse due to structural weakening by the fires from the jet plane impacts. So this is like something we've never seen before. Plus, we had the emotional cognitive dissonance of being in a state of shock because we were under attack for the first time, you know, since Pearl Harbor, which wasn't even on the mainland here. So a number of things were going on there.
Yeah. And of course, we didn't have access to the images about Building 7, of course, at the time, did we? So all we had was this rather strange phenomenon before our eyes.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how did you come to question what you were being told by the official sources?
Well, I think most of us, after we received the word from the experts who had it pretty well canned up for us within days that this was a gravitational collapse, there were 19 fundamentalist hijackers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and nothing about Building 7, the third worst structural failure in modern history. We all just kind of put it away. And 5 years later, in my case, I heard on the radio Dr. David Ray Griffin, who's now written 10 books on this subject, being interviewed in Berkeley, where I was on my way back from a construction meeting and listening. And he's talking about all this evidence of molten iron in the basements flowing like lava, the first responders say. Hundreds of witnesses of explosions. No stack of floors found at the base of the towers. It goes on and on and on. Evidence of iron microspheres and all the World Trade Center dust. I'm going, why? I would have heard about a third tower. What are you talking about? Three towers. This is incredible.
Yeah. This is Dr. David Ray Griffin. So he's a very highly respected scholar, isn't he? A theologian.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's written many other books beside the 10 on 9/11. And he doesn't sound like he's lying. So I listened to him, and I verified what he was saying, and turns out to be true. I mean, I really did look into it quite deeply. In fact, I took that information to the office where I worked for at the time, and I bought these guys pizza. I said, you guys got to come look at this, because they thought I was nuts. I started talking about, you know, controlled demolition. But once they looked at the actual evidence, all of them agreed, oh, my God, you're right. This is a controlled demolition. They all signed my petition except my boss, who was Middle Eastern at the time. Uh-huh. Well, he's still Middle Eastern, but he was my boss at the time.
Okay, so is that what that was the nucleus then, was it, for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth?
Yes, that was our first 15 architects and engineers, including myself, calling for a new investigation. Since then, as you mentioned, we have over 2,000. And I've given now 450 presentations all around the world, including across the UK. We're talking about groups of 100 to 2,000. And by a show of hands, those who see the information after they see it, 90 to 100% of them always end up agreeing with us. Wow. Yeah, you're right. Once I actually look at the evidence, you got me, especially with that Building 7.
Sorry to be facetious, but you still involve pizza in those meetings.
No, I don't have to bribe them anymore. In fact, they come and they pay usually $10, which really helps us to get the word out there. Mm.
So you've got 2,350 plus people who've actually, this is architects and engineers specifically, who've signed up to call for another investigation. But there are a lot of other people, aren't there, who've also signed another part of that petition?
Well, there's 20,000 people altogether. Anybody can sign our petition, others as well. So, yeah, indeed. And there's millions in the 9/11 truth movement around the world.
Yes.
Every major metropolitan area has people out in the street on the 11th of every month giving out literature, usually ours, because it is the most technical, credible literature for the destruction of these three towers that's out there. We've got DVDs, we've got brochures, we've got a booklet that's 50 pages full of evidence.
Yeah.
It's
so
all there.
These 2,300 people, the technical people who signed up to this, are they mostly from the U.S. or all from the U.S.?
Oh, all around the world.
Right.
At least three quarters of them, I think, are from the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering whether that figure is actually a remarkable figure, or is that quite a small number, really?
It depends on how you look at it. I think if I were anybody, and somebody told me, if you knew the 2,350 architects and engineers were demanding an investigation of your house because it was subject to collapse, would you go and learn about what it is that they're so concerned about.
Yeah, well, right? Absolutely, good point, yes. And if I also knew that the idea of pointing the finger at my house and questioning it at all would be something that would be, you know, socially unacceptable, then I might think that was a very significant figure as well.
Yeah, these people all are publicly putting their reputations on the line. This isn't just a casual thing. It takes, I don't know, 15, 10 minutes to put down answer all the questions that we have on the petition. Put your bio there, your resume. It's a significant step for a lot of people, and many of these are speaking like I am around the world themselves.
Yes, absolutely. So you're calling for a new investigation. So what I'm wondering is, how would a new investigation go that's different from the ones that you've had already? I mean, you know, how would you ensure that it wasn't just going to be another whitewash?
Well, that's a great question, because we have given our petition, our technical information, on two occasions, once when we reached 1,000 and then 2,000, to the 535 members of Congress, with receiving very little response, no effective response from them. And same with the media. The media appears to be censoring the story of the crime of the century, including the fact that there's a third tower. And that's incredible, because, you know, any investigation would want to look at the free fall, collapse of a 47-story skyscraper out of the sky at 5:20 in the afternoon on 9/11, not having been hit by an airplane, but which drops as fast as a bowling ball falling off the side of it in under 7 seconds, in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition like the old hotels in Las Vegas that we mentioned. So anybody, even a child, can understand that normal office fires can't bring a building down like that. They'd have to remove all 80 columns on each floor, synchronistically timed, floor by floor, in order to allow the building to fall symmetrically straight down. And then also, as fast as it did, free fall acceleration means no resistance from any of those columns. So that's the kind of investigation we're looking at. Who's going to do it? We have some real issues about finding an independent body that's not corrupted by the moneyed interests that seem to be actively influencing our members of Congress and censoring the story getting in the newspaper, 90% of which, by the way, is owned by just 6 corporations in the U.S. And so there are people who have looked into this and found that those corporations are controlled by the same corporations that control those in the arms industry, the oil industry, the banking industry, the insurance industry, all of whom profited enormously from 9/11.
Right, so there's vested interest here. Yeah, that certainly makes a great deal of sense. Now, of course, a lot of people would say, and people in government would say, well, look, we've had an investigation, even of the technical things to do with Building 7, of the National Institute of Standards and Technology has done this exhaustive study and found that there's no problem. So even if they know about Building 7, they're going to turn to that and say, well, we don't need another investigation.
Yes, they certainly will, and that's what the American Institute of Architects has done when we brought a resolution to the floor, because 50 of our members are signed on to the resolution, which calls upon the AIA to call for an independent investigation of World Trade Center 7. And they lied through their teeth, the board members of the American Institute of Architects, who are representing the deepest pockets in the world that build skyscrapers and huge developments. So we've now realized that my own institution, the American Institute of Architects, has been corrupted as well. And that is a very, very sad tale when they can tell us, for instance, that Building 7 came down due to diesel fuel, which not even the official story says is true. NIST says there was no diesel fuel fires in these buildings. So they're just stretching out of ignorance to deceive their own 400 members on the floor of that annual business meeting in Atlanta last month.
So they just carelessly look at reports and things, don't actually look at the actual 2008 report of NIST. Is that right?
Apparently, because they certainly got it all wrong, in addition to mischaracterizing us as conspiracy theorists when all we were talking about is the facts that a 47-story skyscraper can't be completely shattered top to bottom, one structural element from another, in 7 seconds due to normal office fires. In fact, office fires have never brought down a skyscraper ever in the history of skyscrapers.
It's a great shame to hear that term conspiracy theorist being used. Of course, it's a great thought stopper, isn't it?
Right.
Unfortunately.
Sure.
I'd like to, you've already been talking about some of the details about this, but I'd like to get into a little bit more with you. Could we turn to the evidence that you deal with respect to the Twin Towers first, in a more formal way, buildings 1 and 2, the North and South Towers of the World Trade Center. And as I said, I'd like to have a kind of broad brushstroke approach to this, if I may, to get an idea of how you make a general case against the official narrative. So to do that, could I first ask you to remind us, what is the official story about how those towers actually came down that day?
Yes, the planes hit the towers and there was a large explosion of jet fuel, 90% of which burns up outside the building, according to the official story, too. And the rest of it burns up in 10 minutes, but it starts normal office fires in the towers, which they say due to the impact of the planes on the steel structure knocked some of the fireproofing off, which made it vulnerable to fire. So it weakened due to the fire, and then there was a gravitational collapse. What they say is the top portion, in the case of the North Tower, drove 15 stories in the top portion, then above the point of jet plane impacts, drove the rest of the building down to the ground and then crushed itself. This is called the column failure theory because the perimeter columns failed due to sagging floor trusses, which were weakened.
So the sagging is supposed to have taken place sort of inside the building because of all this heat that's produced, and then that collapses, and then you get the top part pile driving down to destroy the building.
Yes, but that's not what the video evidence shows whatsoever. You see, we're being told this is an orange, but it really is an apple. That's how distinct it is. And few people critically evaluate, even know what the official story says. You know, they think all kinds of things. But what you see in the first 4 seconds is this top portion destroying itself. It's telescoping down in on itself. There's no movement of the building from the point of jet plane impacts down until 4 seconds later. The top portion has been completely structurally shattered. In other words, after hundreds of witnesses hear synchronized explosions and see flashes of light, which is available now, by the way, on the oral histories. You can Google that, the oral histories of 9/11. 118 firefighters are on record, now 156, as seeing flashes of light, hearing explosions before the onset of the destruction of this building, and being blown around in the building prior to its collapse as well, explosions throughout the building. But in the first 4 seconds, what you see visually is that there's nothing left for anything to drive the rest of the building down to the ground. After that, what you see is more explosions, or hear the witnesses, and then freely flying laterally ejected 4-ton structural steel sections at 100 kilometers per hour laterally in every direction, landing 200 meters in every direction. Gravity works down, so there's no pile driver seen in any of the videos pushing the rest of the building down. In fact, the building is tearing itself apart and at almost free fall acceleration yet again, straight down through what? The path of greatest resistance, the 100,000 tons of structural steel beneath this building. And guess what? We don't see a pile of floors at the bottom of this tower. We don't see 110 floors that are an acre in size, each of them. We don't see half of them. We don't even see one of them. What's happening is 90,000 tons of concrete is being pulverized to a fine powder in midair. And then this powder is laid like a blanket through lower Manhattan. 30% of it is concrete, according to the studies. And what's found in it by official sources, the U.S. Geological Survey, is small molten iron spheres, billions of them in all the World Trade Center dust samples, the diameter of a human hair in size or so. And so these are composed of iron, elemental iron, which is, in fact, the byproduct of thermite. Thermite is an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. So here's official sources from the U.S. Geological Survey and R.J. Lee, an environmental consulting firm, doing toxicological studies on the dust, documenting what can only be the residue of the incendiary thermite. They don't even speculate what it might be, but that's all it can be. It is evidence of thermitic destruction.
And I have heard somebody say that, well, maybe it could have been the result of welding when the towers were actually created.
Well, yes, but welding doesn't produce elemental iron droplets the diameter of a human hair, a billions of them, amounting to up to 6% of the World Trade Center dust. No, it's not going to happen. This is evidence of temperatures exceeding, and this is during the event itself, because the U.S. Geological Survey, or R.J. Lee, documented that this was produced during the event, not prior to the event. And, in fact, there's molten iron found by the first responders as well in the basements of the towers. They said flowing like lava. In fact, molten iron or steel is seen in the videos pouring out of the South Tower 10 minutes prior to its collapse.
Yes, and I have in fact seen footage of that. And again, I'm not saying that this is what I believe, but nevertheless the rebuttal has been put that in fact that's aluminium from the aircraft contaminated by furnishings and the like, so therefore it's not burning in the way you'd expect.
And it can't be that, because molten aluminum pouring in daylight is silvery. It doesn't glow bright yellow and white hot like steel or iron does. So it's very clearly...
Sure, but the point that they make is that this is contaminated with furnishings, and so it's not burning, giving the right color.
Right. That is the excuse provided by NIST, but experiments have been done with organic material put into molten aluminum, and it does nothing to increase its color, which gives the temperature of the material, to white hot or yellow. It just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So if somebody's going to say something, they've got to back it up with experiment, not just make it up out of thin air like NIST did in this case. Molten aluminum does not even glow in daylight conditions, much less produce that visual spectrum. So we've got a real problem with all this molten iron, which is evidence of temperatures that exceed what jet fuel and office fires can even get to. They don't even get a quarter or a third of the temperature required to melt steel. But thermite, again, does. And there are patented thermite cutter charges that issue molten iron in milliseconds cutting through structural steel. These cutter charges are much more effective but much more expensive. So why would they do that when they could just blow up the building with normal C4 or RDX charges in shaped cutter charges? Well, those provide loud bangs and bright flashes. So this is a deceptive controlled demolition, a magic show, a grand illusion, where we're supposed to look at the giant fireball and then associate it somehow with that building's collapse. But the building collapses an hour after the plane's impact. After, in fact, in the case of the South Tower, the fires were virtually out in that case. And then you hear all these explosions and see the building completely destroy itself in 12 seconds, top to bottom, shattering one structural element from another.
Well, I think a lot of people looking at the footage would see, of course, that massive explosion taking place when the aircraft actually hit, and then would be quite satisfied to say, well, look, you can see the jet fuel causing all that damage, and so therefore it's reasonable to think it would have produced enough heat to bring those buildings down. You know, in retrospect, the buildings came down. That must be the cause.
Yes. Well, we think the rabbit came out of the hat also. The magician has something else going on behind the scenes. And that's what we're looking at with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. The evidence of explosive controlled demolition. The evidence found in the dust, not only of the residue of thermite, ignited thermite, but unignited thermite as well, in nanothermite chips, red-gray chips, red on one side, gray on the other. The red side composed of what? Extremely small particles of iron oxide and aluminum powder, which are the actual ingredients of thermite, but at a scale that is built from the atomic scale up, nanoparticles, such that the surface volume of these particles is so large that it ignites almost instantaneously. So they've taken an incendiary, they have engineered it to become more explosive. And it's found in all the independently collected samples by this international team of scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen. So these are evidence of a very, very high-tech form of thermite.
Sure. I find that very persuasive when we actually had Dr. Niels Harrit on the show a couple of years ago explaining about that. But since then, I have to say that I have come across, and I did mention this to Kevin Ryan, who gave some explanation about it, but I'd like your take on it as well. I've come across the work of Dr. James Millette, who Chris Moore asked to look at the red-grey chips. And according to Millette, this is not thermitic material because he didn't find any aluminium in the World Trade Center dust, which is a necessary component of thermitic materials.
Yes, but others did find it, and it was there, and these chips did ignite in a differential scanning calorimeter, basically a heater. So at 420 degrees centigrade, these chips ignite, and they produce the same spheres that the USGS documented in their study, but never explained with the same chemical ingredients. And when Millette did his study, he stopped the differential scanning calorimeter heat rise to before that event, presumably because he didn't want to know what happened, didn't want to produce the same results as the original thermitic study.
But do you know if anybody else has in fact reproduced the findings of the Niels Harrit team with respect to finding aluminium in this material?
Mark Basile, an independent chemical engineer, is working on that as we speak. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer to your question. There may be others who have. I just don't know.
No, okay. But it would need to be reproduced, wouldn't it, to be thoroughly scientifically validated?
Yeah, that's the scientific method, you bet.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I wanted to bring up, again, referring back to the debate that you had with Chris Moore, which is an excellent debate, very interesting, was that you were saying about this pile driver and it had been, the top part had been reduced to just particles. And Chris Moore was saying, yes, but we've still got the mass there to cause this pile driving to take place. And you were saying, well, but it's particles. So who is right about that?
If you dump a sack of flour, you pour it out and you dump it on somebody's head, it's not going to break their neck or cause them to fall to the ground. It's in individual pieces that fold themselves around. But you take that same mass of that sack of flour and you keep it in the bag intact, it could very well break their neck and cause them to fall to the ground. So when we're talking about a loose bunch of steel beams that have obviously been completely shattered, one beam from another column, etc., and you allow that to fall on the building, there at least is going to be hesitation from the 80,000 tons of structural steel that's intact and cold and hard below the point of jet plane impacts, and it'll resist any such weight falling on it, at least to some significant degree where it would decelerate the collapse. But that's not what happens. It accelerates instead straight down through the path of greatest resistance. Yeah. And what are seen down below the zone of destruction are squibs or isolated explosive events occurring 20, 40, even 60 stories down with these explosions pushing out solid steel sections and so forth out of the building.
Now, you call them squibs, but others would call them air pressure ejections caused by the internal structure sort of pressurizing as the floors are collapsing. So how can we tell?
Well, if there was pressurized ejections of air being produced by this piston, let's say the upper portion was intact and it was pushing the rest of the building down, there would be air pressure. But we saw that it wasn't intact. It was completely destroyed. So the air pressure would be going up through the path of least resistance. But let's say that that was intact, that upper part of that building, and it pushed that air down. That air would be going out through the elevator hoistway into the open office area of these buildings. And if it blew out any of the windows down below, it'd blow them all out, the glass being the weakest, not these highly focalized pinpoint ejections at these geometrically precise locations.
Are you satisfied that David Chandler has demonstrated that some of these ejections come out through the aluminium itself?
There were aluminum cladding panels on the outside of the building, and indeed many of the ejections are in fact aluminum panels, but you can clearly see the structural steel sections in addition.
Mm. Yes, I have a question from a listener who asks about the nanothermite hypothesis and wonders whether it's really adequate as an explanation, because it doesn't account for what this listener believes to be a fact, that much of the steel itself turned to dust. So how would you respond to that?
Well, there's lots of dust. There's no doubt about that. In fact, it's documented by the USGS that there's 30% of the dust is concrete, powdered concrete to a size of, I think it's 90 microns or something. It's an incredible amount of dust, but none of it is steel powder. There's no steel powder documented in any of the dust, in fact, which is one of the main things that these people who suggest that the steel turned to dust through some sort of directed energy weapon, but they haven't produced any dust that's steel. You know, steel doesn't turn to dust. And if there's no evidence of dust, what happened to the steel is that it is distributed in a 1,400-foot diameter, 200 meters radius all around each of the towers. They're right. There's not enough steel at the bottom of either of these towers. It looks like it disappeared, but in fact, the entire area of Ground Zero and beyond is littered with piles of structural steel sections that have been ejected laterally due to some incredible explosive force.
Yes. And when you look at the video of that happening, that is extraordinary, isn't it? That sort of lateral force throwing those things out. That doesn't seem, I mean, I'm a layperson here, but it doesn't seem to be consistent with, you know, a sort of gravitational event. But that's just the way, you know, it strikes me.
Yes, this is again, physics. Gravity works down, not out. And these are freely flying steel sections. You can see them in the videos very carefully ejected, and they go out, and then gravity begins to take over, so they fall 45 degrees then, and then they start falling down.
Mm-hmm. So in answer to that person's question, then, you're saying that, in fact, the steel was there, but it was very widely distributed, so it just doesn't look as if there's a great deal there.
That's right. And they also point to the remaining spire after the towers came down. And there's something that shakes the towers, presumably another explosion at the base, which shakes the additional dust that was sitting on these beams off of it. And then you can clearly see, frame by frame, the top of this spire going down, responding to gravity in that case. It doesn't turn to dust. It just shakes the dust off.
Yes, I saw that particular footage, and I agree with you, yes. There's a subsidiary question I'd like to ask you, and that is just that what evidence do we have that large quantities of steel were actually removed and shipped away from the site?
Well, the official records show that within weeks, the steel was being removed, in fact, with Building 7 within 2 weeks, and shipped to China. That's acknowledged by officials for recycling. I mean, this is the illegal destruction of evidence in a crime scene. Mm-hmm. We're talking only 250 pieces of steel were saved out of 200,000 tons of steel. The steel is always saved and analyzed, and there's any kind of a structural failure. In the case of Building 7, no plane hit that building even, no jet fuel. And yet, it's the unprecedented complete destruction of an intact 40,000-ton structural steel system, and we didn't save the steel to figure out what happened. We had to rely on NIST's computer model to try to prove what happened, and yet they won't even release the input data for that computer model when asked by the engineers who are responsible with ensuring the public safety. They say, no, it yes. couldn't. It might jeopardize public safety were we to release this information to you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. That's their official response, isn't it? It might jeopardize public safety. It seems to be completely the opposite, but there we are.
Yeah, exactly. It's ridiculous.
So you're saying that it is documented and we can actually read the documents that say, yes, indeed, steel was removed from the site at this early stage.
You know, I haven't seen those documents, but nobody disputes that the steel was removed. I mean, it is gone. It is not sitting in a yard somewhere. I mean, part of the 250 pieces are sitting around. But and when you look at those pieces, you see them having been warped by incredible heat, much more than, you know, the heat than jet fuel or office fires could produce, into noodle shapes. This takes thousands of degrees.
Mm-hmm. Before I forget it, there is a question here from Andrew, who asks if you have conceived of any failure scenarios for the Twin Towers, given that they did actually sustain this damage from the aeroplanes. Might there have been some failure scenario that you could imagine where perhaps you have a partial collapse of those buildings? Would that have been plausible?
Perhaps. If the explosives didn't go off, and if the plane impact damaged enough columns, and the fire was hot enough to actually weaken the steel, it is possible that the top of the building could have tipped over, which did actually happen in the case of the South Tower, but then it begins to right itself again. We might have seen the top part fall off the bottom part in some sort of natural set of events, but that's all speculation. With all the evidence for controlled demolition, we know what happened to those buildings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've mentioned Building 7 a little bit. I'd like to turn to that now. And okay, so when we look at video of this coming down, of course, this is the thing that tips a lot of people off that something very, very suspicious going on here. This was a case with me. You know, I did have questions about it beforehand, but when I saw the video of Building 7 come down, that was the real moment where I thought, heavens, you know, I've got to look at this more seriously. And when you look at it, it does look to, and I'm going to quote here from a BBC reporter, exactly like a controlled demolition. However, the official explanation says that that's not the case. So what problems do you have with the official explanation? This is office fires, and you have the expansion of beams taking place, and then there's internal structural failure, and down it comes.
Well, you mentioned the BBC, first of all. These are the ones that announced the collapse of this building actually 20 minutes before it ever happened. And they give us the reason why, too, by the way. Now, this is the unprecedented collapse of a building by fire, which has never happened before in history. And here they are announcing it in advance, a few small scattered office fires, which were burned out, by the way, over an hour before this building collapsed. How can the BBC announce? There it is, Jane Stanley from the BBC announcing it, and it's standing right behind her shoulder visually, still there. That's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, but according to the producer, it was just sort of the chaos of the day.
Yeah, right. Does this make them psychic? They apologize for this grievous error. I know. It's obviously someone gave them a script that they were simply reading. They got it backwards. It's a problem for them.
Sure, sure. Is it not right that others were also reporting this before it happened?
CNN announced the collapse of this building at 11:07 that morning. Now, that's like 6 hours before it ever happened. Pretty incredible. They said a 50-story building collapsed. There was smoke filled the canyons. And no other building at all collapsed, much less a 50-story building, after the Twin Towers did. There was some damage, certainly, to buildings. But they're referring to Building 7, which, by the way, had it gone down at that time, we wouldn't even have videos of it because it'd be completely obscured by the massive dust cloud released when the Twin Towers were destroyed. So a lot of people think that it was supposed to come down at that time. And in fact, there are mysterious construction workers caught on CNN television walking away from Building 7 in the afternoon, hearing an explosion, looking over their shoulder toward it, and then looking straight into the CNN camera and saying, "Did you hear that? That building's coming down. The building's going to blow up. Flame and debris coming down. That's why we're moving away from it." It had a few small fires, that building did. How's that going to destroy the building or have cause it to blow up, as they said? It's incredible, the amount of foreknowledge here. But your question was about, the official story, which says that these fires, which they claim were raging on the 12th and 13th floor, what they say is that these fires, which, again, were out, so this never could have happened, but that these fires expanded these long-span steel beams, pushing a girder above the 12th floor off of its seat on this column, causing the floor 13 to fall on 12 and 12 on 11 and so on for 9 floors. So this internal instability then traveled upward through the building to the top, allowing the east penthouse to come down. And then it traveled laterally through the building such that the entire building was gutted. And then we see the 7-second collapse. That's the official story, or their hypothesis of NIST. And none of that could have happened at all. It's all completely fabricated, because even if there was an expansion of the steel beams due to fires, which weren't there, but that couldn't have pushed a girder off of its seat, because there were steel studs tying those girders into the concrete up above. But even if that happened, we couldn't have the collapsing of the 13th floor, because there were other girders holding that 13th floor onto that column. But even if that could have happened, the 13th floor wouldn't even have hit the 11th floor. It would have sagged down toward it, but wouldn't have caused a progressive collapse. But even if the progressive collapse could have been caused, you would have seen massive deformation on the exterior of the building, crushing of granite panels and windows, which you don't see at all in the building's behavior. It would have due to asymmetrical damage, you know, this started in one corner of the building. The building would have fallen over, which is, in fact, what their computer model actually starts to do before they stop it after 2 seconds. They don't let us see what happened after this building starts its failure, because the computer model itself begins to tip over and behave like an organic collapse. They can't even control the supposed proof of their theory. It disproves their theory, actually.
That is very, very telling, isn't it? I totally agree with you. And again, looking at it from a layperson's point of view, you know, the explanation that the internal structure collapsed, leaving the shell intact, which then just dropped rather gently afterwards, you know, that does seem to me to be incredibly unconvincing.
Yeah.
And because we've had a conversation with Kevin Ryan poking holes in many of the things that NIST have said about this, and indeed Tony Zambotti, who was saying that NIST actually omitted to mention certain structural elements in its analysis of what happened that day. Do you happen to know what's happened with Tony Zambotti's quest for perhaps even legal action with respect to this?
Well, by legal action, are you referring to the FOIA request that we have to have NIST release their computer input data and all the rest of the data that they're withholding, along with FEMA, from the American people?
Well, this is the letter by Dr. William Pepper bringing attention to these omissions. Do you know anything about that?
Yes. I'm aware that Dr. Pepper had written a letter to NIST, but it has not turned into a lawsuit, because it would take tens of thousands of dollars for us to put together such a lawsuit. It would go through federal courts, which have already proven themselves non-responsive and corrupt, unfortunately. So the decision was made not to pursue that particular legal case. But we do have the Freedom of Information Act in this country, which requires federal agencies to release information that is not classified when asked to do so. NIST and FEMA are holding on to all of the photos, videos, interviews that they've done, and finger pointing to each other as to who's got this and why they haven't released it. So we do have to sue them in a court, which we do expect to be successful in, and that has finally been submitted last month.
Great. Freedom of information, very important. And, of course, that's why Tony Blair over here has said he wished he'd never gone down the line of freedom of information. I wonder why. Now, the destruction of Building 7 is often referred to as the smoking gun of 9/11, and I've already said that it had a great impact upon me and many others who've seen the video of this. Now, it won't be apparent to everybody why that's the case, because, you know, there's a paradigm shift that takes place at that point of recognizing this as a smoking gun. A smoking gun of what? So could you spell out why you believe Building 7 is indeed this smoking gun?
Well, Building 7 is obviously, to everybody, even a child, the result of explosives going off in the building, which remove the structural steel resistance to a free fall collapse, which happens in 7 seconds in the case of Building 7. So everybody who sees it knows that it's a controlled demolition. That's a problem for the official story, because controlled demolitions aren't set up in a day. They take months of advanced planning to set up. This means that we've been lied to by our government and agencies. In fact, the 9/11 Commission report itself never even mentioned the complete structural failure of the third worst structural failure in modern history, in fact. So this means, A, we were lied to. B, this was set up months in advance. C, it's part of the conspiracy, if you will, of 9/11. So if such a huge, obvious portion of the official conspiracy theory is a lie, then we have to look at the rest of it as well, starting, in our case, with AE 9/11 Truth, the Twin Towers. And so we then were forced to overcome our own resistance due to the cognitive dissonance and shock we were placed in that day to look at the scientific evidence in the destruction of the Twin Towers. And when we do, we find that we were also lied to about that, as we've been discussing. This draws into question the entire 9/11 event, which started a $4.5 trillion global war on terror, reducing liberties in the UK and in the US, civil liberties, which we had taken for granted and now have legislated away, where any of us can be arrested without a right to a lawyer, a trial, a jury. We can be tortured and even assassinated. That's untenable. Our economy is in shatters. And it all goes back to 9/11. There's additional seven wars, which all have to do with 9/11 as in some respect as to their source. So if we've been lied to about 9/11, then everything which has changed, you know, the world and our the feeling of safety, you know, in it has to be looked at. It turns out it's a massive false flag operation where one country attacks oneself and blames it on another and goes to war with them as a result, which is, in fact, how most wars have been started around the world. So we've got to get to the bottom of this. So that's why they call Building 7 the smoking gun.
So we are very probably, in your opinion, looking at, you say, a false flag operation here. And so we would be justified, if that's the case, in calling this some kind of inside job. Now, one thing that people might say is, well, you know, you perhaps undercut that by saying, well, could not Al-Qaeda have planted these explosives in the building?
We don't even know who got past the massive security in three of the most highly secure buildings outside the Pentagon. I suppose Al-Qaeda operatives could have done it. I'm actually not going to go on record saying that that's impossible. But it does require an investigation as to who could have done this and what level of penetration over what period of time these operatives would have had to secure. We do have an elevator modernization going on the 9 months prior to 9/11 in the Twin Towers, the largest one in history. Ace Elevator had this contract. They had 85 employees in the building at the time the planes hit them. They fled. They didn't help the first responders. So we certainly want an investigation into this scandal, by the way, documented by USA Today, to find out, you know, where did Ace Elevator come from? Well, they came from nowhere to secure this contract and went out of business after 9/11. Right. So this could have given operatives, you know, months, 9 months before 9/11 to set, place, engineer these explosives. Mm-hmm.
And of course, when we talk about operatives and we talk about access and these various companies and the like with access, then we're perhaps wondering whether the term Al-Qaeda means what we think it means anyway. It all becomes a little bit fuzzy, doesn't it? And as you say, needs to be very heavily investigated. Another question that I have here to do with Building 7 is, you know, on the hypothesis that it is indeed controlled demolition, therefore some kind of inside job, what advantage was there in actually bringing that particular building down? I mean, you've got buildings 1 and 2. Is that not sufficient for the, you know, the neocons to have their new Pearl Harbor? Why bother with building 7?
Well, we don't know the reason. We do know who the tenants were: the CIA, the IRS, the Department of Defense, Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management on the 23rd floor, a bunker designed to control the city in the event of a catastrophic emergency. Very highly secure building. It could be some people speculate that the whole operation was run out of the 23rd floor and to completely destroy that and the controlled demolition could be a part of it. Others speculate that this third plane that went down in Shanksville was scheduled to impact that floor of that building. So we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with all this you've been presenting to us then, if we're persuaded that there is at very least, you know, enough here to raise really serious questions about what happened that day, then what can we do about it?
We've got to let other people know. We've gone through official channels, the U.S. government, the U.S. media. We've achieved very little penetration into these areas. So we are reaching out to the public and the academic professions with a massive outreach. The 9/11 Truth Movement is growing by millions every year. It's a grassroots movement. We're asking listeners to take this, our website, ae911truth.org, and email it to every architect and engineer you can find and elected representatives and everybody you know. That's how the word is spreading about this mass deception called 9/11. We've got to educate people, and so there's a DVD on YouTube. You can Google Experts Speak Out, 9/11 Experts Speak Out. Search that on YouTube, and you can see the one-hour version of our DVD, and you can get the 90-minute version on our website and our store at ae911truth.org. That's the main action, and people can do that right from home, right from their computer, or right from their phone.
Now, I'm not trying to be negative at all, but I just want to bring this up because some people are saying that the 9/11 truth movement has failed. And I think they mean in the sense of a lot of what has been accomplished is not seen because it's about changing people's minds rather than people signing up to particular things. So do you think that's the case, that in fact the 9/11 truth movement has not failed, that it's actually doing incredibly well? We're just not seeing what's happening.
Oh, that's a fair question, Julian. I'm concerned that we haven't made the progress, the penetration into mainstream media that we would have liked to after 9 years. It's also indicative of the level of sleepfulness that's going on in the public, as well as the success of the engineering of our minds through the media,
sure.
Which appears to be quite scientifically effective. So what we do know is that people in general on the street have a different attitude. More than half of the people are open-minded to the idea these days, and half of those people can actually cite the points of evidence. That wasn't the case 5 years ago. So we're making a penetration into the subconscious of the public, and maybe, you know, it's the 100th monkey effect where all of a sudden everybody's going to become aware somehow through this unconscious force. And maybe at that time, more people will take greater action with respect to forcing an investigation on the part of political elected representatives.
Yes, Andy, you mentioned about how there isn't much penetration into the mainstream media. Of course, there is into the alternative media in the widest sense we might think of that. However, are you concerned about disinformation, even in within the alternative media? Because, of course, we several years ago had Cass Sunstein's conspiracy theory article, which is calling for what he called cognitive infiltration into 9/11 groups and other groups like that. And, of course, it's not even necessary that that gives rise to people actually putting in disinformation. The very fact of writing that means that you're creating mistrust amongst people, and therefore people are calling each other shills and all that kind of thing. Are you very concerned about what's going on with respect to that scene as well?
Well, yeah, it's very disturbing to have one of the Bush administration members actively call for infiltration of people who are raising questions. Benjamin Franklin said it's the first duty of every citizen to question authority. And that's what we're doing. We're simply asking questions, and in our case, scientific questions about the crime of the century. You know, if there's any question, they need to be answered. They need to be looked at and not infiltrated.
Yes. And the very fact that there is that call for infiltration is highly suspicious in itself.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, I'm afraid, is where today's interview ends, which I know is rather odd. I do have to admit that. Indeed, I had not planned it that way. In fact, it was my fault entirely. I had agreed to a one-hour interview with Richard Gage, and I overran because I just wasn't keeping my eye on the clock. And it turns out that Mr. Gage, quite unknown to me, has an automatic system that brings online new phone calls and new Skype calls for his next interview, and that system just cuts off the previous call. So that's what's happened just there, and I was left talking, and, well, he just wasn't there anymore. But as I say, it was entirely my fault for overrunning, and I didn't really want to bother him with having to come back on later just for the sake of tying up the interview with a few ending pleasantries, because obviously he's a very, very busy man indeed, and when I messaged him, he was absolutely fine with that. Anyway, I had asked him pretty much everything that I had intended to, except for one thing which I can mention now. And that's an event, an important event, I would say, that's being held today and tomorrow. And as I'm recording this on the 11th of September itself, I mean today, the 11th of September, and tomorrow, the 12th of September, an event called Rethink September 11. Now, I don't know if this is formally connected to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, but that's quite by the by. It's called Rethink September 11, or more formally, 9/11 Global Interactive Broadcast, The Lies of the 9/11 Attacks and the War on Terror, which will be a video broadcast at this webpage, rethinkseptember11.wordpress.com, rethinkseptember11.wordpress.com. And let me quote from the About page, quote, "For the 14th anniversary of September 11th, 2001, a live broadcast will be provided on this website for the world to view and to submit questions and comments to in real time. Many notable researchers that have critically examined the official account of the events of 9/11 will present their analysis on the failures of the official story, the negative impact it has had on our world, and why it's important to investigate what happened on that fateful day. We hope that you will join us for this special broadcast on Friday, September 11th, and Saturday, September 12th, 2015, end quote. And that's going to include important speakers like Kevin Ryan, Graham McQueen, Daniela Ganza, James Corbett, Barry Zwicker, each of whom have been on this program in the past, and other speakers, Bev Collins, Anthony J. Hall, Elizabeth Woodworth, Cynthia McKinney, and David Johnson. And it's a live interactive broadcast, so you should be able to submit your own questions and comments in real time. So if you have something to put to these key researchers and activists, this is a great opportunity to do that, which you will be able to do during the broadcast itself via this email address, rethinkseptember11@gmail.com, rethinkseptember11@gmail.com, or via the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/rethinkseptember11. So that starts today, 11 September, 6 p.m. Toronto, 3 p.m. California, 11 p.m. UK, that's BST, or 10 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. I leave you to work out how that relates to you and your own time zone, wherever you happen to be on this globe. And I hope if you manage to hear this podcast in time, you'll be able to catch the video broadcast and perhaps even get your questions answered as it proceeds. So that's it for this week. Once again, I apologize for the strange end to that interview, and also I apologize for the very long break since the last program here at The Mind Renewed. The summer holidays turned out to be even more chaotic than usual. They were enjoyable, but chaotic and unpredictable. But hopefully we'll be back on track now for the autumn series of programs here, hopefully weekly or almost weekly as usual. So please do check out the schedule page at The Mind Renewed for what's coming up soon. So for now, I'll say cheerio in good English style, and God bless. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, of themindrenewed.com, and I look forward to speaking to you again in the very near future.